The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And now it's time for the talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello, good morning to you. It is just turning 5 minutes past nine on this Thursday, the 13th of July, 2023. How are you all keeping? Thanks to Lee for a interesting, entertaining 2.5 hours. He's back with you tomorrow morning at 6:30, of course. We're here for you for the next 3 hours. Loads lined up for you. We want you involved in the chats, in the conversations, expressing your opinions, passing on your stories. 086 60 25,000, WhatsApps and texts to that number, 00353 86 60 25,000, if you're listening outside the Republic. If you want to give us a call, Caroline and Niamh, taking your calls this morning, 074 91 25,000. That's 074 91 25,000. And emails into us from comments@highlandradio.com. Jaconal Tribune this morning. A total of, the Milford Town First draft plan published this week has a staggering 32 locations identified for remedial attention, with 11 of these described as key projects. A total of 4 are described as high priority or higher priority, with a price tag of €3 million for each one. Councillor Liam Blaney welcomed the development, saying that he's happy that his proposal for the regeneration of the town had been processed so quickly by the council. Nevertheless, he said that many changes would be needed before the draft is finally published as a plan. He hoped that all 4 higher priority level plans can all be progressed at the same time. However, the Loch Road Junction and the regeneration of the hotel site is the most urgent one. I would hope the council can now proceed with urgency to get the Part 8 planning process before the end of this year. Until that is complete, funding cannot be sourced, he added. More, of course, on the front of and inside the paper. The Donegal Democrat tells us that the Minister for Justice, Helen McEntee, says the effectiveness of a 3-county model for policing will be analysed before a firm decision is made on the future of the Donegal Garda Division. Under proposals for a new operation model, the Donegal Division will be amalgamated with the Sligo and Leitrim Divisions. A similar amalgamation has already been rolled out in Mayo, Roscommon and Longford. This venture is now being assessed by senior officials in a bid to determine the next steps for the force in the northwest amid growing concerns over its direction. Minister McEntee has said that the new model seeks to release frontline Gardaí from roles that can be effectively carried out by civilian Garda staff. The Donegal News. First steps on long road to recovery. A rally enthusiast from Remalton, who was seriously injured in a motorbike accident 1 year ago, is working towards getting back in the driver's seat. Brendan Friel was critically injured when his motorbike collided with a car on the main Remalton to Letterkenny Road last August. And as the first anniversary of the horrific accident approaches, he's offered a heartfelt thanks to all those who've played a part in his recovery. And he's pictured too on the front of the paper as well. The Derry News this morning. What has been branded a controversial housing proposal in an already densely populated area lacking in green spaces is being opposed by a local residents group. High Park Residents Association is also seeking support from local councillors against the development earmarked for the Creggan area of the city on land adjacent to the popular Termanbacher Retreat Centre and High Road. Speaking to Derry News, a spokesperson for the association said it had organised a petition opposing the proposed development following a community consultation event held by the planning consultants acting on behalf of the developer. If you want to have a comment on that too and raise the issue here, 00353 86 60 25,000 is your WhatsApp or text number. The controversy facing the BBC has moved on significantly since it was last referenced on the show yesterday. Hugh Edwards, who is synonymous with BBC coverage, whether it's a queen passing, a king being ordained, crowned, or whatever it might be, or if there's a major tragedy, Hugh Edwards was the face of BBC News, the highest paid journalist there. Well, he's now been named as the BBC presenter facing allegations over payments for sexually explicit images, as the Metropolitan Police said they had found no evidence of any criminal offence. The decision to name Edwards by his wife, Vicky Vicky Find or Flind, last night brings to an end days of speculation over the identity of the presenter at the centre of a media storm over its alleged relationship with a series of young people. In a statement on his behalf, now it's clear to say, in terms of them, the way it's phrased here, over his alleged relationships with a series of young people, there's no real details on that other than there was no crime committed whilst they were younger than he. And you may or may not agree whether that's right or wrong. And clearly, obviously, he's married because his wife has issued a statement on his behalf. The police have found that there was no illegality, no wrongdoing. Well, in a statement on his behalf, Miss Flind said Mr. Edwards was suffering from serious mental health issues and was receiving inpatient hospital care. She added that he would respond to the stories when he was well enough to do so, but that might not be for some time. And she also referenced the fact that he has had well-documented, long-standing issues with his mental health. And he's the latest presenter or personality or someone in the public eye who is not... and I'm purposely choosing my words correctly because I don't want it to sound like I'm saying something that I'm not, but it seems that more often than not now, if there is an indiscretion or if there is a controversy, that mental health, be it in Ireland or in Britain or wherever it might be, is cited as a potential reason, or at least then why someone might not be able to answer questions. And I get that, and that's understandable. How that would be determined depends on the person, though. Is it like, you know, that it would upset me so greatly to respond to some questions, not on this issue, but on others, that might damage my mental health and therefore I'm not available for it? And also, you know, there are some that might feel it might do, you know, there's lots of people that suffer with their mental health that never do anything wrong or anything like this. And I just wonder if there's any views out there in relation to that. 086 60 25,000. Well, the Welsh journalist who has been the lead presenter of the flagship News at 10 evening programme for 2 decades is the broadcaster's best paid news reader, earning more than £430,000 last year, which actually is not far off what a lot of presenters here are getting paid. He's broadcasting to over 100 million people. Anyway, RTE's head of sport has said GEA matches for the controversial streaming service GEA Go were absolutely not cherry-picked. This is The Independent. Declan McBennett told the Oireachtas Media Committee there is no conflict of interest between the GEA and RTE in relation to GEA Go. He told TDs and senators that RTE is contractually obliged to show 31 games for Liam and Sam, the All-Ireland Hurling and Football Championships. He said he does not accept that the GEA and RTE are complicit in putting games behind a paywall. When registering for GEA Go, users are asked which county they support. Mr. Bennett said categorically, unequivocally, the data is not used to decide which matches are shown. That being said, there was one big game, arguably the best game of the championship in hurling at least, which was supposed to be on RTE and then was switched to GEA Go. But they've made about 4 million, right, which is pittance really, isn't it, in the wider scale of both RTE and GEA organisations. And further to that, some games have 1,500 people watching them. Can you imagine 1,500 people? The top game had 120,000 people watching it. That's on GEA Go. But if that game were on RTE, you can triple or quadruple that figure. And you can, the 1,500 viewership game, you could probably put that up in the hundreds of thousands because people will just switch it on to watch a game. They don't want to pay 12 quid for something they're not interested in. But if it's on the telly, they'll watch it. I just don't understand that. And I still don't get why two of the football quarterfinals were behind a paywall as well. I don't know. I don't think that's going to change. The GEA don't really seem to buckle too much. But I thought it was quite interesting yesterday. I've never spent so much time watching Oireachtas committees, but I feel it's important that I do for a programme like this. And you have to excuse me. I don't know who it was on behalf of the GEA commented about the controversy about cash. Do you know, it comes up on this show all the time about people not being able to pay for tickets at the turnstiles. Well, apparently... this is what was said, that the GAA had told counties that they can take a bit of cash if they want to, if someone turns up, not to turn people away, which I didn't know. Did you know that? Have you ever had success in this regard? So apparently, on a case-by-case basis, very ad hoc, strange way of doing it, but the GAA did say to counties, you can take some cash at the turnstiles, but send it back to us. And last year, they sent back 15 grand, I think, 15,000. Now, they use that as an argument as, well, there's not that much demand for people turning up with cash. But did you know that you potentially could turn up with cash? Because that what was said yesterday, that the counties were informed that they can take a bit of cash. And this was actually in the league games, just to be absolutely clear. I'm not sure how it. I'm not sure what the situation was as it relates to the championship. It wasn't referenced, and I can't draw a conclusion from that. But from all the league games last year, 15 grand was returned to the GEA that was taken as cash. But again, did anyone out there know that this direction had gone out to counties that you could pay? Although it was a wee bit murky as to how you could or what the scenario might be, but you could pay into a game with cash. Anyway, I just found that part of it a little bit interesting. The Mail tells us that controversial nature restoration laws were passed in the European Parliament yesterday, but farmers warned they retain real and genuine concerns over the proposals. The EU's flagship environmental laws survived a bid by centre-right politicians to kill the bill, passing with 336 votes in favour, 300 against, 13 abstentions. The final text will now be negotiated by MEPs and member states, aiming for a deal to be struck before the end of next year. So it's past the most recent hurdle, but there's still seemingly quite a way to go. The Farmers Journal, their top story today. The agriculture sector can meet its 25% carbon emissions reduction targets by 2030 if there's a massive take-up of key measures in order to slash emissions, Chagas has predicted. Its modelling of current livestock trends would set a 29% drop in suckler numbers and an 8% increase in the dairy herd by 2030. Under the scenario, an ambitious uptake of measures outlined in Chagas's new marginal abatement cost curve, such as reducing the finishing age of cattle by 3 months and increasing use of protected area, would be required to meet the target. On to the red top tabloids now. And nearly 100,000 people in suicidal distress reached out last year to Pieta. This is in the Irish Daily Star. Of that 100,000, the majority were female. Pieta's annual report detailed the counselling provided across the country to people with suicidal thoughts, those who self-harmed or were bereaved by suicide. A spokesperson for Pieta's 2022 annual report, Pieta in Your Community, which was published yesterday, said Pieta's helpline received over 99,000 calls and texts last year. Some 63% were female. Pieta delivered over 51,300 therapy hours free of charge to almost 6,900 clients in 2022, and some 670 families were supported by Pieta's suicide bereavement counsellors, is the headline statistics from the 2022 annual report there from Pieta. The Irish Sun this morning. Only 27 rooms out of 3,000 at the National Children's Hospital have been finished, and the cost of building it could balloon to nearly 2.2 billion. Now, the overall figure is something perhaps I should take more interest in, but personally, not the programme, not the station, but me, I don't know how much it costs to build a massive state-of-the-art hospital. I don't know what's cheap and what's expensive. I know people build houses for 30 million. I don't know what's in but I don't know, is 2.2 billion? It's more than... It is more than we thought it was going to be, but how much does a massive hospital cost to build in this country now? We did look at this before, and we saw state-of-the-art hospitals built in Dubai, I think it was, or the UAE. There was someone who worked on them that joined us on the show, and they were built for like less than a billion. But I don't know how things have changed with inflation and all that type of stuff. But I think the key figure here is there's 3,000 rooms. Only 27 of them have been finished. That's terrible, isn't it? Well, the shocking details emerged at the Oireachtas Health Committee yesterday. The hearing was told that under 1% of the rooms expected to be completed by now at the Dublin site have been finished. Not great. And finally, a story here that police are investigating the burning of a car at the home of a Aintu representative as a sectarian hate crime. The incident happened in the early hours of Wednesday in Newry, County Down, following July 11th Loyalist bonfires across the north and on the eve of Orange Order marches. Sharon Loughran said she awoke at 3 a.m. to find her car was on fire, describing it as a terrifying situation. The paediatric nurse added, just after 3 a.m, awoke to the smell and sound of an inferno beside my house. I looked out of the window to see my car parked in my driveway, consumed by flames. The heat was so much that the fascia's pipes, electric and windows to my house have all been damaged by melting. The arsonist that set this fire could have killed me. This could happen to anyone in 2023 is incredible, she said. Right, okay. That was a run through some of the stories making the front of and inside the newspapers. We're going to be joined after the break by Roy Greenslade. He's a former professor of journalism and editor of the Daily Mirror. And just to get his views on, well, not only what has been happening in terms of the controversy at the BBC in Britain, but really, I suppose, how it's been reported and where we're going in that regard. We'll get his views after these. Stay right where you are. The BBC is to renew an internal investigation into Hugh Edwards after his wife revealed that he's the unnamed presenter accused of paying a teenager for explicit images. Police say they found no evidence of criminality, though. On yesterday's Newsnight, two BBC employees claimed they've received inappropriate messages from the now suspended host. Now, we have some expert insight into this now by Roy Greenslade, who's a former professor of journalism and editor of the Daily Mirror. Roy, a very good morning to you. Thank you so much for your time.
Good morning, Greg. Morning.
See, this is a difficult story to talk about because we can talk about the decision The Sun made to publish this story when it did at that time, or we can talk about it now when we have so much more information. I mean, what way would you prefer to come at this? Firstly, I suppose, in publishing this story as they did, was this a public interest story or just interesting to the public, do you think, from an editorial perspective?
Well, now, The Sun, I think, are in the box here on this. I think, look, this is the situation. If no criminality was involved, then there's no overriding public interest. So it becomes interesting to the public. Now, in its first story, The Sun hinted quite clearly that there was criminality involved. They backed away from that afterwards, and I think that's where their problem lies. They sort of doubled down on that in succeeding days by making other accusations, but I think they're now in the firing line over this matter because they have incited the public, as it were, on social media to speculate. And there's a former Sun editor, David Yelland, who today has been hugely critical of his former paper over this matter. And there have been plenty of other media commentators who've taken the same line. So although the BBC have questions to answer, we can go into that. I think it's The Sun which really need a proper investigation. For instance, where was the evidence? They've not produced any evidence as yet that that this young man had done something with Hugh Edwards, which was illegal. We now know the police don't believe that happened. And there appears to be, they've intruded, as it were, into a family split here between a mother and a stepfather on one side, and this boy who is now 20 years old on the other. And they appear to have done that in an irresponsible fashion and at the same time made allegations and started a sort of hair running so that it was natural that people would start to speculate. And so in that sense, I think the newspaper really have many questions to answer.
And as well, too, a very important element of this is that they were contacted on Friday by the young person who stated that nothing untoward had happened, nothing criminal had happened. So they had knowledge, but they still decided to run with the angle from the person's mother and stepfather, which is really quite remarkable altogether.
It is extraordinary. I mean, the boy, I keep calling him that, but the man got his lawyer to say that it was, and he used that phrase, rubbish. And yet the Sun continued. And they are, and today they are still sticking by their story and its value to society. But I can't see, and I think most other people can't see, that that's the case. What they've done really is led a hue and cry, no pun intended in this sense of Hugh Edwards, but they've led a hue and cry against this man for doing something which, by the way, may involve misconduct. We don't know. And that's the other thing, Greg. The most important thing is we are so deficient on facts in this story. Right from the beginning, when you get anonymous allegations made without any evidence or proof to be shown, you are in a very mucky territory in journalistic terms.
And the newspaper industry has changed too, hasn't it, Roy, which would which might have influenced whether or not they named the person in the first instance or not. I mean, going back a number of years ago, they probably could have sold 3, 4, 5, 6 million euro, 6 million copies off the back of this story and made that editorial to do so now. But now they rely much more so, do they not, on adverts. And now, you know, advertisers will look at this type of publicity and wonder, do we want our adverts in that paper or on their online platform? You know, as I say, I think the way papers are funded is much more different now, and maybe that's why they chose in the first instance not to actually run with Hugh Edwards' identity.
No, I think the reason they didn't run is because of the threat of the libel law, defamation. 20 years ago, I would say they would have used the name. They would have taken that risk. But we've seen a great tightening up both the privacy law and defamation law ever since. If you cast your mind back to the BBC's ill treatment of Sir Cliff Richard, that definitely was a watermark, a watershed moment in which you could see that the privacy law would kick in much more. We'd be more careful than ever before. So I think the former Sun editor from 20 years ago is on the record as saying that he, in the old days, he would have published the name. But so they were, in that sense, careful. But funnily enough, although this was anonymous, it achieved, in a sense, what the Sun wanted it to do in the first place. Let me take up your second point about how papers are funded. If you go back to the days of phone hacking, what brought down the News of the World and led to its closure was a revolt by advertisers. But I think in this case, there's no sign of revolt over this matter. So I don't think that will affect the Sun's funding. Okay. I think you're right. Things are very different. Printed newspapers are hardly bought at all. But there's still massive online interest, even at the Sun, which has, I think, the second largest audience in Britain in terms of online.
The BBC, they have released a timeline of what they knew, when they knew it. And then we also have Hugh Edwards' timeline now, where the first he heard about this was last Thursday. What's your observations on the BBC's handling all of this?
Well, I think the BBC's initial mistake was not taking up the complaints seriously at the beginning. I'm a bit sympathetic, though. They get hundreds of complaints every day. How do you weed out which is the really serious one? They did evidently try to make contact with the complainant afterwards, but didn't make, to use their phrase, didn't make a connection. I understand they failed to leave a voicemail, which seems to me to be a terrible oversight. So I think the BBC need to investigate why they didn't deal with the complaint properly in the first place. That, as far as I can see, that's their only major error in this matter.
And just in relation to Hugh Edwards' return, if he becomes well enough to do so, and that's his wish, how can that happen in this day and age for someone who's so highly paid and in such a high position? You know, even if nothing criminal happened, there perhaps is enough there now to chip away, you know, maybe the status or the reputation or the profile, the holier-than-thou almost, to be able to... I can't see a pathway for him getting back to his former position, because some mud sticks, and I don't know. Maybe you... Can you?
No, I... Look, what matters... Hugh Edwards is an extraordinary anchor on major news events. He covered the coronation, he covered the death of the Queen, he's covered every major sort of royal event, major news stories. And what counts whether an anchor, a news anchor, is trust and credibility. And I'm afraid that it's going to be hard for him to win that back. In fact, I don't think he will be able to win it back. So I don't think it's possible that we'll see Hugh Edwards in that role. If indeed he has a job in the future, I don't think he'll be in that role. He's 62 years old now.
Yeah,
he's had a very long run at the BBC. But there are many, many people who could step into his shoes. And so I just don't think the BBC would ever risk giving him that kind of job. National treasure at one point, he's now really, I think, past news.
And this might sound like a bizarre question, but it's a curious, I'm curious about it and very curious in your views on it, Roy. You know, in 10, 15 years' time, where they're going back into the archives to cover how they covered these types of stories, do you think his reputation is so damaged that they might try and avoid his inclusion in that?
Well, of course, famously, the BBC avoid any mention or any clips of somebody called Jimmy Savile.
Mm.
So they've certainly censored themselves over that. So it's possible, but I would have thought in his case, it's very different. Yeah, Savile was a different kind
horrendous
of case.
Individual.
I wouldn't have thought they would have edited him out of the highlights from the past. I just don't think that's possible.
To say, it was just a curiosity I had, and I was interested in your views.
I mean, look, they showed clips last night of him announcing the death of the Queen. That's in the archives, will be there forever, and I don't think that they'll be worried about using it in the future.
Okay, I shan't keep you much longer, but I must ask you about our own problems here with the with the national
Mr.
broadcaster.
Tuberty. Yeah.
Mr. Tuberty, it's a different thing because, you know, you could say that in Britain it's a Hugh Edwards scandal and not necessarily the BBC scandal as such, though there is questions over its handling. And over here, the way it's being framed is it's the RTE scandal and not the Ryan Tuberty scandal. But the same questions remain in that some mud sticks and reputations get damaged. Can you see a way back into the nation's hearts and, more importantly, maybe his colleagues' hearts to see Ryan Tuberty return to the airwaves on RTE?
Well, going on what I've seen, I would say that the nation is split on Tuberty. So there are those who believe him and those who don't. And I think that's a real problem for him returning to the roles he's had previously. I would imagine, I mean, we're deficient on facts in certain ways, and it will be so incredibly interesting to see what RTE have to say about his evidence and that of his agent. But I would have thought that the split is quite clearly there. On the other hand, think about this, Greg. He has been really very harsh on RTE. He blames everything on them. I'm innocent and so on. But that RTE that he was criticising is no longer there because Backhurst has come in, the new DG, and got rid of everyone. So it's a sort of new RTE. There's a sort of post Tuberty RTE. So maybe Backhurst will feel, I tell you what, he's valuable enough for us to keep him, even if we don't give him the leading roles we gave him in the past. Mm. So I don't think it's necessarily all over for him.
And can I flip that a little bit, though? Because as Backhurst tries to change the culture within RTE, and that's really, really important that is seen to be done, whether it's fair or not, Ryan Tuberty may always be seen as the poster boy for that old culture. And I just wonder, in that context, can he fit into what needs to be a new RTE, even if he's very popular and excellent and what have you?
Yeah, and I think, you know, we haven't mentioned the major problem here, which is that he allowed people to think that he was earning less than he was earning. And you know, that was published and on the record everywhere, his salary, and of course it wasn't quite his salary. So, and I think he can't overcome that. And I think that's a problem. For those like me who believe that he did must have known and should have known what he was earning. I mean, it's extraordinary. I think you know what you're earning, unless you're getting payments from Renault. We don't know about Greg, but
I've got no extra payments, but I almost feel like saying, hey, here's my email address, but no, I shan't know.
I think the larger point here is not about Tubridy. It's about the funding of public service broadcasting here. And that is that messing it up with commercial deals, side deals like the Renault matter. Yeah. Really, we should think much more about, should RTE be funded currently in this mixed fashion between commerce and a license fee?
And very finally, Roy, what has really jumped out at me today is that Hugh Edwards, on £500,000, albeit, broadcasting to a potential audience of over 100 million, and we've got people, individuals in this country with a population of Manchester to broadcast into, 5 or 6 million, and they're on €500,000. It's, wow, that's crazy, isn't it?
I know. I think it's extraordinary. And I kept saying to myself, and I know a lot of people have said this, why did they feel it so necessary to pay him so much? Where was he going to go? There's no big competition for Ryan Tubridy's hand. So I think they have overpaid. And I'm astonished at the earnings of RTE.
And they're doing it again with his replacement on the Late Late Show, Patrick Kilty. They've bidded themselves. They valued his services £250,000. But Patrick Kilty presented a couple of episodes of The One Show 10 years ago. I have a lot of respect and admiration for him. His last TV appearance that I saw was on Celebrity Catchphrase. You know, where does the €250 price tag, 100,000, 250, where does that come from? RTE struck that or set that, because it's not in the market here. There's no comparison other than what they were. So in other words, they're saying they need to change this culture of bidding against themselves, yet they're doing it live still right before our eyes, finally, Roy.
Well, of course they did that before this great scandal broke. I would think they'd be revising that now. Patrick probably saying to himself, I got under the wire here. I'm rather lucky.
What about me and you co-hosting it? We'll do it for 80 grand. You're all right for money. I could just take the most of the 80 grand. How's that, Roy?
Yeah, well, that would be fine, because I'd do it totally for free.
Yeah, all right. I'll take the rest. Have a lovely day. Thank you for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks, Greg.
Thanks so much. That's Roy Greenslade, former professor of journalism and editor of the Daily Mirror, and has been commenting quite widely on that story right across the British media as well. So it's great to have him back on this programme. Greg, it's the nature of media that how little time we spent dissecting the Children's Hospital compared to Tubridy and Hugh Edwards. Thanks. Indeed, but you see, I think it's getting our heads around it. There's very important committee meetings today, or there should be very important committee meetings today, taking place discussing defective concrete blocks. You know, and there's no coverage of it whatsoever. I mean, we'll try and do something after the fact here, but we don't have a news channel to stream it out or what have you. But that's 3 point. That's 3 point. That is 3 point. At least 3 billion. Of taxpayers' money. And there's not a word about these committee meetings that are taking place today to discuss defective blocks. Yet we've had wall-to-wall coverage, of which we've been part of, because there's a great deal of interest out there, about the movements of €345,000, which is still significant and it's important and it's in the public interest to discuss it. But we've got a €3 billion controversial scheme up for discussion today in the Oireachtas committee rooms, and not a pip. So it's not just the Children's Hospital and our scrutiny of that. That being said, on this programme, and it wasn't just me, I think Sean used to discuss it too, there was an awful lot of people upset about the plans, the sites, the location of the Children's Hospital. There was strong, strong objections that saying this is the wrong kind of development in the wrong place. It should be elsewhere. It should be made differently. We don't need all the bells and whistles. We just need this facility, and so on and so forth. And that was covered extensively on this programme and others, I'm quite sure, and yet on it progressed where it's at. OK, back with more shortly. OK, so we read yesterday that a new Leaving Cert sex education curriculum will normalise lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender and other LGBTQ plus identities, relationships and families, rather than marginalising them in standalone lessons. The government's curriculum advisors say the approach to be taken with students will be inclusive, underpinned by the principles of equality, human rights and responsibilities. And in fairness, after we covered that article yesterday, we were contacted by one parent who was backed up by others who said, look, I've raised my children as Christians. I don't want them compelled to go in through the Leaving Cert cycle and hear about these things. But everyone's got different views. But let's find out exactly, you know, how this is formulated and what's in there as much as we can. Annette Honan is National Council for Curriculum and Assessment Education Officer. Good morning, Annette. Thanks for your time.
Good morning, Greg. Lovely to be with you. How are you?
I'm great, thanks, Annette, and I hope you are too. Right, OK, so this draft, new draft sex education curriculum for the senior cycle is being published. How was it? How is something like this formulated, Annette? Who has input into it?
OK, Greg, well, can I first just, you've referred to a new sex ed programme. So just for clarity for your listeners, to be aware that it's not actually a sex ed programme. It's a programme in social, personal and health education, of which within that an aspect is relationships and sexuality.
Understood.
Education. But just to be clear that it's a very broad curriculum. It includes education around all aspects of health, including emotional and mental health, which is really important. I was listening to your programme earlier and you referred to the Pieta House report that's just come out, and 100,000 calls came in last year to that line alone. So we have a huge concern around youth mental health at the moment. I would hazard a guess that the majority of those calls were either from young people or parents of young people who are concerned about their mental health. So that this is just an example of one aspect of the curriculum that's really important. Now, in saying that, obviously there has been some attention to the aspects of the curriculum that relate to relationships and sexuality, and I'm quite happy to talk about that too, but I wouldn't want parents to think that that's all that this is about. There's so many other aspects. There's also a really important aspect to the new curriculum that I think parents in particular will be interested in hearing about, and that's the aspect that deals with preparing young people as they transition into adulthood. Because we're very conscious, when we went out to have a huge consultation in recent times around senior cycle education, parents in particular said that they felt that the whole area of life skills is not being properly addressed within senior cycle. And young people are going out into whether it's college or the workplace or further education, and they don't have the skills they need sometimes to be able to manage themselves and to be able to manage all of the different challenges that they face. So within this updated curriculum for senior cycle, there's a strand that's called into adulthood, and it looks particularly at helping young people to develop and establish good habits so that they can self-manage themselves, their emotions, take care of themselves, that they know how to exercise their rights and responsibilities, including being able to show care for and respect the responsibilities of others. And
it's a reminder,
others.
Isn't
so
it?
It's a huge curriculum, yeah. Greg. And I just
exactly. I really I'm happy. I'm happy for it to be a broad conversation, Annette, because that's why we invited you on, so that we have a better understanding. Because what happens is we can get very reactive to certain elements. Not even if you're very pro them or very against them, rather than looking at it in the round. And a lot of this talks about, if you're in a relationship, be it a friendship or a relationship, what is right, what's wrong, what's acceptable, how you, not only how you treat someone, but how you can expect it to be treated. Not everyone has that information.
Absolutely. And all of the work we're doing is grounded in consultations. Since 2018, we've been out. I've been up and down the country, including in Donegal, meeting with teachers and students and parents there too. And this is one of the key aspects. We say, what is this? What's the really important things young people need to learn in this area? They say, we need to learn how to create and maintain healthy relationships, be able to recognise what a healthy relationship looks like, be able to have the skills to know how to respect boundaries, how to communicate feelings, how to manage conflict, all of those important things.
Okay, and before we get into that then, so I want to put to you what some people say, and I suspect to know the answer, but I want to hear it. But parents will go, well, that's our job. I want to do that. I don't want that to be talked about in the school. I'll do that with my child. Now, the point I tried to make yesterday, and I'm not for or against this, by the way, I'm just sort of trying to chair it, but I says, look, not every parent's comfortable with doing that or does do it. And that's why, you know, not every parent can teach their child geography, and that's why we have geography classes. And it's the same with other areas of development and growth. So then what is the logic in teaching these things in schools and not leaving it up to parents and guardians and caregivers to do it?
Great question, Greg. It's an important one, because it's important to say we're not in any way usurping the role of parents. This is a complementary role we have. We're partners in education with parents, and all of the research shows that a number of things. One is that as young people grow, and in primary school, we all know, I suppose, even as parents, it's much easier to talk to our children. They're much more receptive and open to talking to us about things. As they grow older, they become less receptive to having these conversations with their parents. And even with the best relationship in the world, parents experience this. So that's one factor to take into account. The other is the fact that the research also shows that where schools are doing good relationships and sexuality education, instead of closing down conversations with parents, it actually opens them up, because students are more inclined then to go home and have a chat with the parent and say, oh, today in classroom we were talking about this or that. And parents also have an opportunity then, because good practice is that schools will inform parents that this is happening in their school, and they will know, and they'll be able to say, oh, I know that you've been learning about this in school today. What did you learn? Can we have a chat about that? So it's actually opening conversations at home. It's not closing them down, and it's certainly not usurping the role of parents.
What I would love to see, if it's not already there, though, is like a video on YouTube, anonymised, you know, it doesn't have to be real, but an example of a teacher speaking to students and what they're talking about, particularly, say, for instance, in areas that are highly controversial, not controversial, topics for discussion at the moment, like, for instance, LGBTQ plus identities, relationships and families. Like, I think a lot of commentaries in a vacuum, or people are getting the information third hand. I don't understand why an example of one of these talks is not produced on YouTube or some other platform or on a Department of Education website, so everyone can see precisely what is being talked about and how it's being talked about. And then from there, people can truly form their own opinion as to whether it's okay or not okay. And it's that kind of involvement of the public and parents that removes maybe other parties with their own agendas and really empowers parents to think for themselves and make these decisions.
Great point, Greg. You're absolutely spot on there. And it is, we do understand that when people open up a draft curriculum and they see the learning set out, the first question is, but what will that actually look like in the classroom? What does that translate at? What does that really mean? What are the kinds of conversations that are going to be happening in the classroom where my child is? And we're very conscious and aware of that. So what we're doing is we're developing what we've called SPHE toolkits for teachers. And any parent indeed can access these and look at them as well. If they go to curriculumonline.ie and look at SPHE toolkits, there's a junior cycle one, for example, there now that's been developed for the new junior cycle curriculum. And it's been developed also now for this new senior cycle. And within that, we have these guidance documents for which will unpack, in a sense, what's happening. And it kind of takes the hood up on underneath the bonnet of the car. And the teacher, or anybody can look and say, OK, so if a teacher is teaching about consent, what are the kinds of conversations that will be having in the classroom? What are the key messages? What are the kind of resources that the teacher might be using? And that's all on our toolkits. And we're building that up. Now, your idea of having actual examples of practice and of teachers showing good practice in the classroom is also something we're working on, but that's going to take a little bit more time, because as teachers become confident in working with this curriculum, we hope that they will then allow us to share their practice, to talk to them about what they're doing, possibly even to video some of what they're doing and to be able to share it, because that is really important. The curriculum in itself is just the first step. That sets out the learning, the important learning, but we need to provide more than that. We are aware of that, and that's why the SPHE toolkits are being developed. So we hope that they'll be very helpful, not just for teachers.
So looking down through a lot of the other stuff that we talked about, relationships, about pornography, whether or not you believe that to be a reality, or all that kind of stuff, I think the majority of people go, right, okay, that's useful information. But it does come back down to people. Not just Christians, there might be other religions as well, who are not comfortable with their children being taught or for LGBTQ plus identities, relationships being normalised. Because for many people, and within those, within this community as well, they're not really comfortable with certain elements of that. So why is that included, and how will that be discussed, as much as you can sort of paraphrase it, I suppose?
Yeah, sure. Well, the reality is, within all classrooms, there's huge diversity. There's diversity of sexual identities, there's of sexual orientations, of faith and ethnic diversity, of abilities, and so on. And teachers are all sensitive to that. And all what we're saying by including that note that's in the draft specification, and I have to stress, this is a draft, so it's open for consultation, and we're very open to feedback. And there will be changes to this on foot of the consultation, as there always is. But we have a note within the specification that says that the learning should be taught in a way that LGBT plus identities, relationships and families are fully integrated and reflected in the teaching and learning. So what that means is that the teacher is sensitive to the fact that there is a diversity of young people in front of them, and that they teach in a way that doesn't exclude anybody. And just to give you some examples, so for example, if you're talking about romantic relationships, you don't always assume that it's boy meets girls. That you would use other examples, for example, and be acknowledged that it's that the world isn't made up of people who are attracted male to female only. That you'd also, in talking about families, be aware of the fact that some of the children in front of you
might
be coming from families that are different than mummy and daddy.
Yeah, can I move past that, if you don't mind, a little bit, and with respect, but it's just a time, your time as well as anything else. In terms of lesbian, gay relationships, bisexuality, the fact that a child can have two parents, again, I think the majority, you know, understand that. I think it's when we start talking about transgenderism or trans issues, and people identifying and we don't even really know how many genders might actually be included in this. We get into that space, then people start thinking the seed planting, indoctrination, you know, all the words that be used, programming children, that there's not actually a public consensus on transgenderism and identifying as different or no gender. And I think that's where people start being uncomfortable, is this being normalised in the school environment when society really hasn't figured it all out yet.
Absolutely. And we have a real guidance on this, and we'd be delighted for people to go and have a look at it on the website. It's in relation to junior cycle and the teaching around this area, because it comes up in learning outcome number 3.6 in the junior cycle updated specification. And just in brief to say to you, what we're saying to teachers there is, number one, they're not experts in this area. It is a very complex area. And in fact, they are well advised not to go into detailed questions around, you know, the medical aspects of transgenderism or anything like that in the classroom. That is not helpful. But what is helpful is for teachers to, as I said before, to open up conversations in a way that at least acknowledges that there are diverse ways that people express and experience their gender. And also to acknowledge that in the teenage years, it is a time when young people are maybe questioning all aspects of their identity, not just their gender identity. And they might or might not question their gender identity. Many don't.
Yes, but that's happened for generations.
That's an important message too for the teacher.
Of course it is, but that's happened for generations. And
exactly.
What parents are afraid of now is that as people go through that confusion and wondering, well, why do I find that person attractive, or why don't I feel like this, is that we are giving them pathways. Do you know what I mean? We're saying, well, and then they go, actually, well, maybe I am trans. Do you know what I mean? Or maybe I could be. Do you know what? Mm-hmm. And that's where parents, I think a lot of parents then have the concerns. Yeah. But Annette, listen, I hope you're happy with it. It was a balanced and useful conversation. Annette, thanks very much for your time. I really do appreciate it.
In conclusion, say thank you, Greg, but also to encourage parents and students who might be out there listening,
look at
or indeed
yourself,
any interested person, to go online, have a look at the draft, and do provide us with your feedback, because it's really important to us, and we take it all and read it all very carefully.
And it's
Thanks so much, Greg.
I think, important that individuals look at this themselves and not rely on somebody else's assessment of it. Okay, thank you very much indeed, Annette Holnan there. Okay, back after the news and obituary notices.